Hello, and welcome to my podcast. This is an audio version of my videos, available to make listening to my stuff in the background easier than YouTube makes it. But since my videos are primarily made for YouTube, there may be occasional references to visual materials. If you'd like this podcast ad-free, you can join us on Patreon at patreon.com/vicerhino. Please enjoy. Hello, and welcome to my channel. Vice Rhino here. Today, we're looking at a video from the Ravi Zacharias International Ministries YouTube channel, and for those unaware, the ministry has, as far as I can tell, mostly shut down since the news broke about Zacharias' sexual misconduct, and it looks as though they're actually using ministry funds and his life insurance money to pay for support for his victims, rather than taking the Catholic strategy of using the money purely for self-defense and trying to make themselves look good. That said, I can only really find this information on their site and on Christian news sites, so take it with a grain of salt. Anyway, I just wanted to address the elephant in the room before I got onto the video, so in this one, they ostensibly provide credible evidence for God outside the Bible. So let's take a look!
One is from a college student who asks, does a vast, giant universe disprove God?
Before he gets into it, my initial reaction would be that no, it does not disprove a God. Though, as I pointed out in my last video, and will likely get to again here, I think the God described by the Bible is far too petty a God to be responsible for such a vast universe. There are just so many things that the Christian God supposedly cares about that, on the grand scale of things, are entirely inconsequential. Like whether you wear mixed fabrics or plant two different crops in one field. Now, sometimes these rules are said to have been put in place for the benefit of humanity. Like, don't eat pork isn't because God hates pigs, despite having made them. It was because pork is a harder meat to cook safely than others. Never mind that chicken is allowed and it's an even more difficult meat to cook than pork. But when we look at the laws against planting different crops in one field, that's actually detrimental. Some crops are complementary, and crops like beans actually aid in nitrogen fixation in the soil, so planting beans alongside plants that have high nitrogen requirements, like wheat for instance, can give you better yields for both crops than you would get from planting either one on their own, and as a bonus it takes up less land to do so. Also, beans provide good habitats for beneficial insects that help protect other crops from parasites and other pest insects. Why would God prohibit complementary crops in farming? Surely the Creator would know which plants play nicely together and so could provide helpful instructions along those lines instead of just outright banning it, right? So the God who created all the wondrous vastness of the universe gets his knickers in a twist if you plant beans with wheat. I feel like he probably has more important things to worry about than that.
And then the second one comes from someone called Isaiah, who wants to know, is there any evidence for God outside of the Bible?
And for that one, I would again answer no. The most robust arguments for the existence of God usually boil down to a God of the gaps argument. We run into a spot where our knowledge ends and say that because we don't know that yet, it must be God. We don't know exactly how consciousness first arose and don't fully understand how our brains produce consciousness now, therefore God. We don't know how life first developed, therefore God. We don't know what came before the Big Bang, therefore God. We don't know why the universe is capable of sustaining life, therefore God. Etc.
And how can we know if this evidence is credible?
Those are great questions, and they are related. The second one actually has some aspects, not just, I think, of science, but also of history.
Not really. As far as science is concerned, God is an untestable hypothesis that some people float when they can't figure something out. And as far as history is concerned, historians pretty much universally discard supernatural claims because history is all about figuring out what most likely happened based on the accounts of an event that you have. It will always be the case that when reading accounts written by human beings, it's more likely that the person was mistaken or even just lying than that a supernatural event actually happened. So it's pretty much impossible to examine historical documents and come away with the idea that the supernatural events depicted in those documents are actually supernatural. Now, that's not to say that historians never accept supernatural claims. Plenty of historians are Christians, after all. But you cannot say that these supernatural claims are facts of history, like you can with, say, the fact that Sir John A. Macdonald was the first Prime Minister of Canada.
Because one of the things we ask about is there evidence outside the Bible for Jesus? Not only his existence, but what he did.
Yeah, there's not much, but there is some. And unlike the mythicists, I tend to hold the position that the most probable explanation for how we got the documents about Jesus is that they were based on a real guy who might have said or did some of the things in them, but there's really no way of figuring out with any degree of certainty which things are accurate and which things are not.
When I started to investigate the faith, originally to knock it out, to basically say this is not worth believing and to challenge Christians as to why they believe what they believed and then show them that what I believed was actually true.
Yes, that familiar old trope. I investigated Christianity specifically to prove it wrong. Well, at least this guy puts a bit of a different spin on it than we're used to, as he was Muslim before converting to Christianity, so it's not the tired old I used to be an atheist trope, but it definitely shares a lot of the same features. But as with so many ex-Christians that I know, my journey to atheism started with me desperately trying to prove Christianity right. I didn't want to deconvert, I wanted to hold on to what I had. But alas, one cannot choose what they are convinced by, and I found myself unconvinced.
And I began to see some what Al Gore would call inconvenient truths, which is that there's plenty of evidence outside the Bible to not only believe that Jesus existed, but that he did what he said he did.
Here's the thing, though. I don't know what evidence he's going to bring up yet, but let's just assume for argument's sake that it is 100% convincing. Doubting the story of Jesus is not what ultimately led me to becoming an atheist. It was reading through the Old Testament and learning that the all-loving God that I had learned about as a Christian was not the same as the God described by the Bible. Yes, the first biblical inconsistency I noticed was in one of the Gospels, but that resulted in me deciding to read the Bible from start to finish because spending time in the Word of God is supposed to bring you closer to Him, and that's what I wanted. But I was an atheist by the book of Joshua because clearly the loving God of the Bible doesn't actually exist, because a loving God would not behave in the way that the God of the Bible is described as behaving. And throughout this process, I kept looking for answers, trying to figure out how to reconcile what I had learned about God and what the Bible clearly teaches about God. And all the apologetics and reconciliations seemed to be just grasping at straws, engaging in mental contortions at an Olympic level, violating their own principles in the process at times. Like the same people who will tell you that absolute morality is a thing and that something is right or wrong regardless of the circumstances, will also tell you that genocide is okay as long as the victims of the genocide were bad enough people. That didn't sit well with me. So, yeah, maybe an impressive magician was wandering around in first century Judea and then gained a decent-sized following, ended up on Rome's radar, and was executed, but even if you believe all that, and believe that the authors of the Gospels were actually eyewitnesses who really believed what they were writing, that's not enough to counter the fact that the God of modern Christians cannot be found within the pages of the Bible. And then you learn that the gospel authors were not eyewitnesses, they copied off each other, they made mistakes about culture, geography, and historical events, and that the vast majority of the non-biblical mentions of the person of Jesus come from people describing what Christians believed about him rather than talking about him as an actual historical person, and the whole thing just falls apart.
And the Bible says he did. Now, I was a Muslim, so I believed in Jesus as a prophet, as someone who performed miracles, was born of a virgin, and all these things. So I didn't necessarily need the proof of that, but I wanted to challenge even that belief, because I wanted to believe it was true, not what was tradition.
So, by his own admission, he started his challenge of Christianity from a place where he already believed most of it, and he wanted to continue to believe most of it.
So I began to look and see for the evidence. And what we see is not only that the Bible itself is a reliable source document for the life of Jesus. In fact, most scholars will tell you the Synoptic Gospels and the Gospel of John and the Book of Acts are the primary source documents we have about what happened in the life and times of Jesus of Nazareth in the first century.
Well, yeah, of course they'll tell you that the only documents we have about the guy's life are the primary documents about the guy's life. That's not really a surprise. But also, most biblical scholars work at religious institutions, many of which require their staff to sign statements of faith. So coming to conclusions that go against the statement of faith would be discouraged. Of course, this is not to say that there aren't biblical scholars who do good work in the field, but this is the only area of history where a good chunk of the experts in a specific time period are bound by their institutions to not question certain aspects of the history, and we should be aware of that when looking at their conclusions. Honestly, I know how much they disagree professionally, but I would love to see more scholars like Ehrman and Carrier. We need more experts in that specific field that don't go into it with a priori beliefs about what their conclusions will be. So I want more mythicist scholars like Carrier and more non-mythicists like Ehrman to come in and have a big battle royale of ideas so that the one that actually has the high ground in the debate of Jesus' existence can come out on top without the taint of, but I have to believe it because my job depends on it.
And they're very early sources as well. So I don't want to discount that, because when we ask the question about things outside the Bible, the assumption being made is that because the Bible says it, it must therefore be biased.
Well, no, the assumption in history is that every document is biased, and so we need to figure out the bias in order to parse reality from embellishments. In order to do that, ideally we would want to see accounts written at the same time and from different perspectives. We kinda have that with the Gospels. We can see some of the motivations of the authors based on what parts of the book of Mark they changed and how they made those changes and how the story changed even further by the time John was writing. But it's not like we have an account written by the Romans of this new cult leader doing amazing things that just has to be put to death before his following grows to a point where he could start a rebellion, or by the scribes and Pharisees who were supposedly present for so much of Jesus' ministry about this radical rabbi who keeps upending their teachings. And we can actually learn quite a bit about early Christian beliefs from what we have. I would highly recommend Dr. Ehrman's book Lost Christianities for more of a deep dive on the different sects of Christianity that existed in the first and second centuries before any sort of centralized governing body got a hold of the various Christian documents and decided which ones were the official orthodoxy and which were heretical. So, from these early documents, we can learn that in the time and place when Mark was being written, Jesus was viewed as a fully human man who was adopted as the Son of God at his baptism. Matthew and Luke differed slightly, but they still both portrayed Jesus as a human man who struggled human struggles and was scared of his fate on the cross, even going so far as to beg God not to make him do it, but who always wound up making the right decision in the end. John, on the other hand, never had Jesus show any signs of weakness at any point, with him even ordering people around while he's in the process of being executed. So, from these different perspectives, we can learn a bit about the various biases that the various authors had, but it still doesn't give us a lot to go on as far as figuring out what parts of the story are actually true goes.
And therefore we need outside evidence to corroborate it, otherwise we're really approaching it from a biased witness.
Yes, that's because every text, modern, ancient, in between, or otherwise, was written with a bias, and we should want to know what that bias is before evaluating the truth of the claims made in the document. Now, sometimes we can learn about the bias that an ancient author had from reading accounts from other sources for the same event, and then apply what we learned of that person's bias to other documents written by that person for which we don't have alternate accounts, but we can't do stuff like that for the Gospels because we don't even know who wrote them.
So as a lawyer, I can tell you this. Whenever you put a witness on the stand, there's always a perspective that that witness has.
Yes, always. And if we're taking the Gospels as witness accounts, even though it's pretty well established in the scholarship that they are definitely not, then we need to figure out their perspective in order to properly interpret them, figure out the author's motivations, parse out truth from falsehood, etc. You don't just get to start with the assumption that they are completely unbiased and completely true because reasons. You need to actually demonstrate that they have reliability.
But you don't assume the bias unless it's proven through extrinsic means.
And this is where the study of history differs from a court of law. Every historical document is assumed to be biased in some way, and part of the historian's job is to figure that out. In a court of law, it's innocent until proven guilty, because we don't want to ruin someone's life unless we're sure that they've actually committed the crime. Or at least that's the principle. It doesn't quite work that way in reality, but that's what we're aiming for. So if someone says, "I saw the defendant rob that store," in order to discredit such a witness, you might bring up that the witness has a long-standing feud with the defendant, which might cause them to want to see them go to jail, guilty or not. But such a motivation cannot be assumed outright. But for the study of history, nobody's going to be locked up for years if we learn that something historical happened in a way that we didn't previously think that it had. So we start the examination of every historical document with skepticism about the author's motives and intentions, and then we look for accounts written from different perspectives to either back them up or contradict them before we draw any conclusions with any amount of certainty.
So what you would need to do is find evidence outside the witness's testimony to find out if the witness is biased. So with the Bible, you don't approach the New Testament and say, I assume it's biased until proven otherwise. You assume it's not biased unless it's proven to be biased.
That is literally the opposite of how history works.
I'll give you an example of this. If you were to take Holocaust survivors and ask them for their testimonies about what they went through in the death camps.
Okay, we're going to go ahead and skip this bit. Suffice it to say that the Holocaust survivors are indeed biased, but that doesn't automatically make their statements untrue. In fact, looking back at World War II, probably the most biased people you could talk to are the people who were directly affected, whether that be the victims who survived or the soldiers who committed the Holocaust. But when we examine the actual evidence, we find that there is significant support lending credence to the experiences of the Holocaust survivors, both in physical evidence and in corroborating accounts from other survivors. But what this guy will tell us is that because the evidence corroborates their accounts, that means they are not biased. That's just flat out not how bias works. You can say true things that may still be biased in how you say them. When I say that God created the universe with magic, that is essentially true to the beliefs of those who believe that God created the universe, but I have obviously put my bias into the statement to make it sound sillier than what the people that believe that would like. Bias does not equal untrue.
I think the same thing is true of the Bible. Just because the eyewitnesses put their accounts into an orderly fashion for us to read doesn't mean that they're biased.
Orderly is a funny way to describe the gospel accounts. I mean, yeah, the author of Luke did say that he was creating an orderly account, but I can say that I took a shit that smelled like freshly baked cookies. That doesn't make it a true statement. Worth mentioning is that Luke's claim of putting the story in an orderly account is often used as an apologetic for why several of the events of Jesus' life are presented in a different order in the different books. The idea is that Mark was writing down what he was learning from Peter in Rome, and Peter was not teaching in chronological order, so Mark's book is out of order, and Luke corrected that by putting it back in order. The most interesting part of this apologetic to me is that some of the people I've seen use it will insist that Matthew, Luke, and John were all eyewitnesses while Mark was writing down what he was hearing directly from an eyewitness. So the people who believe that two eyewitnesses to actual events for some reason decided to directly copy, word for word, the account written by a non-eyewitness rather than put those events in their own words. So the authors of Matthew and Luke were either super-duper lazy, or they were not eyewitnesses. I'ma go with the scholarly consensus here and say that they were not eyewitnesses. And remember, this is the same consensus that starts off with the assumption that certain aspects of these stories have to be true. So the people that have a vested interest in the Gospels being actual accounts of real events can agree that none of them were written by eyewitnesses to those events.
It means that they may have recorded it the way it was supposed to be, that way. And you do see corroborating evidence outside the Bible for the crucifixion and the resurrection of Jesus, or at least the claims of that.
Yeah, you see how he had to add the caveat with the at least the claims of that? That's because the strongest evidence for Jesus' crucifixion comes from passages like that found in Tacitus, which reads, "Nero fastened the guilt and inflicted the most exquisite tortures on a class hated for their abominations, called Christians, by the populace. Christus, from whom the name had its origin, suffered the extreme penalty during the reign of Tiberius at the hands of one of our procurators, Pontius Pilate." Now, there are two ways that I can see to interpret this. Either Tacitus is confirming that Jesus, that is Christus, actually existed and was executed, or he's just operating under the assumption that Jesus was a real guy because he didn't see reason to believe otherwise. But even so, of all the extra-biblical mentions of Jesus and Christians and their beliefs, there is only one that I am aware of that so much as mentions the resurrection, and that's the Testimonium Flavianum, a passage found in Josephus' Antiquities of the Jews, which is universally agreed by scholars to be at least a partial forgery, with the part about the resurrection being one of the parts that pretty much everyone agrees was a forgery. So, yeah, the evidence here is not great, to say the least.
So much so, when you have Josephus, a Jewish historian, when you have Cornelius Tacitus, a Roman historian, when you have Pliny and you have other historians outside who are hostile to the Christian faith.
Well, we've already talked about two of those, Josephus and Tacitus. So what does Pliny have to say? Well, to summarize, Christians would meet on a specific day of the week and sing hymns to Jesus as if he were a god, then they split up, then they'd get back together and eat a meal. This is as much evidence for the existence of Jesus as me describing the activities of a church in my area would be. That is to say, none at all. I've left a link down below to J. Warner Wallace's article on the evidence for Jesus outside the Bible. You can find all of the most commonly quoted ancient sources for the life of Jesus. I highly recommend actually reading them so you can see just how weak they are for yourself. And then read Wallace's conclusions about these passages to see just how much stretching he does. Probably my favorite one is the first one, Thallus. We only know about him because he was mentioned by Julius Africanus as having said that there was an eclipse in Judea. We don't know any of what Thallus said about this eclipse, we just know that he said there was one. Wallace even laments that if only we had more of Thallus' work, we might find confirmation of the actual crucifixion. Immediately before going on to say that from Africanus mentioning that Thallus mentioned an eclipse, we can conclude that Jesus lived, he was crucified, and there was an earthquake and darkness when he was crucified. Excuse me? Where did Africanus or Thallus say anything about an earthquake? Where is Thallus' mention of Jesus at all? Did he mention the crucifixion? No, he didn't. So why would we conclude from a mention of an eclipse without reference to anything to do with Jesus, that Jesus lived, was crucified, that there was an earthquake, and that the eclipse mentioned coincided with his death? That is a huge jump, and that's the first extra-biblical mention of Jesus that Wallace lists on his site.
Who are actually telling us that Christians not only claimed that Jesus died on the cross, but they were willing to die for the fact that they ascribed to Jesus as having risen from the dead.
Nah, they don't usually mention that. What they actually do usually mention, such as can be seen in this passage in Lucian, is that the Christians are willing to die because they are operating under the belief that they are immortal and will gladly go to their deaths because they ultimately don't believe that death is permanent. There's no mention of Jesus' resurrection being the reason for this, but even if it were, that again would just be another instance of someone reporting on what these people believe, rather than reporting on the actual event of the resurrection.
And that evidence is really strong.
Now comes the part where we throw our heads back and laugh. Ready?
Ready!
This is one small facet of the gospel narrative. It's the chief facet, but if you were to look at the existence of God and all the evidence that mounts there, I think it's pretty impressive.
And I disagree.
Time doesn't allow me to go into all of it, but let me just suggest a couple of things here, is that when we look at the way the universe is constructed, and we look at just our solar system, for example, our solar system, our planet happens to be in what's called the Goldilocks zone. It's just right for life.
I mean, it's just right for the kind of life that evolved there, sure, as would be expected. But it's also not a very specific zone. The Earth currently orbits an average of 150 million kilometers away from the Sun. This distance is called an astronomical unit, or AU. Researchers have calculated that the habitable zone for our Sun is between 0.9 and 1.5 AU, or between 135 and 225 million kilometers away from the Sun. That is a 90 million kilometer range. Now, certainly when compared to the whole of the solar system, it's not exactly massive, but it's not exactly tiny either. Then consider the fact that we've already found a bunch of roughly Earth-sized planets in our local stellar neighborhood that are all in their stars' habitable zones, and we come to realize that this positioning isn't really all that uncommon, with research papers finding that there could be anywhere between 300 million and 40 billion Earth-like planets orbiting in their stars' habitable zones in just the Milky Way galaxy. And that's not even getting into the fact that the habitable zone is all about where liquid water can exist on a surface of a planet, and there are a bunch of scenarios that can sustain liquid water outside of a star's habitable zone, like how the tidal forces acting on Europa keep its subsurface ocean liquid. So yeah, Earth really isn't all that special in the grand scheme of things.
Our planet is exactly where it needs to be. Now, why is that? Because of the balancing act that's happening. When you look at our solar system and you see a gas giant the size of Jupiter, that planet pulls on us through gravitation. That planet pulls on us. So it pulls us just far enough away from our sun so we're not too close.
Nope, it sure does not do that. In order for Jupiter to act that way, it would have to be much closer to us, and it would have to have an orbit that kind of matched ours, so it would always be behind us, pulling us in the right direction. But if you know anything about orbital mechanics, you know that that just isn't possible. Now, Jupiter and Venus together line up about once every 405,000 years or so, and give our orbit a slight tug, rendering it slightly more elliptical than before their tug, but the Earth wouldn't fall in closer to the Sun without these periodic tugs. Its orbit would just be more circular than it is. Yes, it is possible that these tugs have impacted the Earth's climate from time to time, and so could have impacted life on the planet, but we're talking effects here to the degree of why didn't tropical dinosaurs have a greater geographic range, rather than life couldn't exist without it.
Plus, that gas giant, with its massive gravitation, pulls in large debris from around the solar system and things that orbit us all the time. Big rocks, asteroids, meteorites, these kind of things that would smash into our Earth and destroy all life here.
This one's a bit of a mixed bag. Jupiter actually does protect us from long-period comets. Usually as a comet enters the solar system, Jupiter's effect is to essentially sling these comets back out of the solar system before they can get close to Earth, which has, over the long haul, significantly decreased how many of these comets impact the Earth. But that said, Jupiter's gravity likely prevented the debris that became the asteroid belt from coalescing into a planet, meaning that the very existence of a huge pool of asteroids that pose a potential risk to our planet was caused by Jupiter. And on top of that, just to be mean, I guess, Jupiter has the effect of occasionally nudging these asteroids toward the Sun, where they have a greater chance of hitting the Earth. So, no, Jupiter does not make the Earth perfectly suited for life. On top of that, even if we assume that Jupiter is necessary for life, there are plenty of other star systems out there with Jupiter-sized planets. Combine that with how many have Earth-sized planets in their habitable zones, and there is bound to be some crossover.
That's just two facets, our distance from the Sun and the existence of Jupiter. That's just two facets. Then you take into account the idea of the Moon, the fact that the moon, our satellite, we only have one, and it's abnormally large compared to its main planet.
Okay, just to skip his description, the importance that the moon has for the development of life is that it creates cycles in our tides, and this could have been a factor that allowed abiogenesis to happen in the first place, and might have allowed evolution to take certain paths in the past. We don't actually know if this is a necessary factor for life, but it might be. And while moons like ours are incredibly rare in our solar system, we have no way of knowing at this time just how rare they might be through the rest of the galaxy. We have likely detected a few exomoons, but at the moment there are zero confirmed detections, so we can't do the same statistical extrapolations with moons as we can with planets. But as there's nothing particularly special about our moon, I mean, after all, there's nothing physically impossible about it, we have no reason to believe that the Earth is the only planet in the universe with such a moon. And also, there is likely quite a bit of variability in moon sizes and distances from their planets that would achieve the same effect as our moon, and having multiple moons could likely accomplish the same thing. So while it is possible, likely even, that the moon did contribute to the development of life, it's also likely that its contribution was not specific enough to require a moon with the exact parameters of our moon in order to work.
And our planets are far enough away from each other based on other facets of the universe. So for example, if I were to look at where our solar system actually is in our galaxy, you know, the Milky Way is a spiral-armed galaxy. And we don't live inside a spiral arm, one of the big Milky spiral arms. We don't live inside of that. We live in one of the dark spots in between the spiral arms. We're not too close to the center, otherwise we'd be destroyed, nor are we too far away.
Now, let me ask you, hypothetically speaking, if life developed on its own without the intervention of a god, where would you expect to find it? Where it would be destroyed, or where it would not be destroyed? Where it would not be, obviously. How is it remarkable that of the billions of planets in our galaxy, life developed on one that's capable of sustaining life?
We live exactly where we need to live so that we can actually have a maximum view of the visible universe.
And that part, as far as I can tell, is just luck. For all we know, there are aliens who live within the bright spots of the spiral arm of the galaxy who can't see out as well as we can. And really, if you're saying that God put us out here so he could show off, a better way to show off would be to put us on a rogue planet in between galaxies. I'm sure the all-powerful God of the universe could figure out how to sustain us on such a planet. Maybe not even a rogue planet, but an entire rogue solar system. Just one solar system, alone, all by itself, not in any other galaxy. Now, wouldn't that be something? And then we wouldn't have the bright patch of the Milky Way blocking a good chunk of our view of the sky.
That's remarkable, because what are the odds that the only planet that has observers on it, like us, happens to be in the prime spot to observe things?
It's awfully presumptuous of you to assume that the Earth is the only planet in the entire universe with observers on it. Now, I've been saving this clip for when I thought it would be the most relevant, and I think it's time to use it. So, you guys know that first deep field image taken by the James Webb Telescope? Well, if you align it with its position in the Unwise Sky Survey, you can then zoom out to see just how tiny and insignificant it is compared to the whole sky. And in that minuscule, tiny sliver of the sky, we see hundreds of galaxies, each containing billions of stars. And it's the same view everywhere we look. There are an estimated 2 trillion galaxies in the observable universe, with an estimated 100 billion stars in each one. And somehow, out of this billions of trillions of star systems, ours managed to be the only one with a configuration that all evidence suggests is somewhat commonplace even just in our own galaxy? And even if there are others configured that way, ours is the only one that developed any sort of life? I'm sorry, but I just don't buy that. Even if the odds are 1 to a trillion against an Earth-like planet existing with the characteristics that the Earth has that are necessary for life, that still leaves us with 200 billion Earth-like planets existing with the characteristics that Earth has that are necessary for life in the observable universe. And so far, with all of the characteristics that you have listed as being necessary for life, it looks like they are fairly commonplace in other solar systems. So while the vastness of the universe does not necessarily disprove a god, it definitely leaves plenty of room for life to develop without one.
Now this goes back to the original question then. Does a vast universe disprove God?
No, but it does make him look completely unnecessary. And as mentioned earlier, extremely petty if it's the God of the Bible.
And she says, I'll tell you what though. The universe is bigger than anything anyone's ever imagined. So if it's just us, it seems like an awful waste of space. I remember thinking, that's superficially, you know, sort of uplifting, but it's actually a little bit on the shallow side. Why would it be a waste of space?
Just for context, that was regarding the end of the movie Contact. I skipped some of the lead up for it. It would be a waste of space because it is a huge, vast amount of space. We will never be able to explore even a tiny fraction of a percentage of it, no matter how long humanity lasts. The idea that it was all made for our enjoyment is incredibly arrogant. And the idea that God would make it just so that we could enjoy it and be impressed with him makes God look incredibly narcissistic.
You see, when we think of evidence and we think of the universe and science and history, we tend to put God into this sort of very efficient box. Like if God exists, he would be an engineer who wouldn't waste space, who wouldn't do things extravagantly. He would do things exactly as efficiently as they need to be. Why would that be the case?
I mean, I suppose you're right. God could just be a wasteful show-off. Is that the God you want to worship?
Why would it be the case that a vast universe makes us insignificant and therefore means that this is all part of a big cosmic accident that didn't have us in mind?
The vastness of the universe doesn't make this all part of a big cosmic accident, but it definitely increases the likelihood that life happened without any sort of intent behind it. And yeah, it does make us insignificant, pretty much by definition. Humanity will never have a significant impact on the universe. It's just not possible. So we are insignificant. Of course, this doesn't mean that our lives are insignificant when it comes to our own perception. My life is very significant to me. But the universe don't give a shit what I do with it.
Or could it be the fact that this little pale blue dot exists as a seemingly insignificant part of a vast universe that happens to have a gas giant and a yellow sun and other galaxies and other bodies within the universe pulling and pushing in a way that makes life on this universe, on this planet possible, so that we can look at the celestial heavens, this vast universe, and see that God is not just an engineer, he is also an artist who paints with a brush that is so extravagant because he wants us to discover the universe he created.
So God is a wasteful show-off. Got it. That's it for this one. Today's comment of the day comes to us from Larry G, who says, "See, you pose yourself as a man of science, and one can see you just hate God. Two facts from history. When they dug in Pompeii, they found evidence of Christianity, like crosses, already being there, and that was 79 AD. When Rome burned in 64, Nero blamed Christians for the fire. This history goes right back to the apostles themselves, and they claim to have seen the risen Lord. I have no doubt that some of those Christians in the Roman Empire very well may have known Paul or Peter before they died, and they heard directly from them that Jesus rose from the grave as the gospel says he did. Okay, first, I don't hate God. I don't think that God exists. And to answer the inevitable, well, then why do you spend all your time talking about Christianity then? It's because of the real-world consequences that come from belief in God, not a hatred for the fictional character of God. Second, yeah, I'm not really surprised that there were Christians in Pompeii. Pompeii was a major port city in Italy. We know that Paul was within about 50 kilometers of Pompeii during some of his travels through Italy, sometime around 60 CE, so it's not unreasonable to think that some Christians made their way there before Volcano Day.
So where were you last night?
Down the Thermopylae, I bet.
Cavorting with Etruscans, Christians and all sorts.
Third, yeah, Nero tried to scapegoat Christians for the fire. Not sure how that's supposed to prove Christianity at all. And no, the history does not go right back to the apostles themselves. At best, you get back to Paul. We have no idea what any of the apostles were doing during Paul's missionary work, and we have no idea what happened to the vast majority of them. Thanks for watching, thanks to Tim Robertson for being my Patreon manager, Charles for being a PayPal hero, and special thanks as always to my patrons, Mark Hetchum, Lightfoot, Ashwin Selva Kumar, and all the rest, who are the deep field images to the telescope that is my channel. If you'd like to prove that the universe is bigger than God, you can join us on Patreon for as little as a dollar per week over at patreon.com/vicerhino, or by supporting the channel in one of the other methods that can be found at links.vicerhino.com, which is also where you'll find links to my other projects. If for whatever reason you want to send me stuff, my PO Box address is in the description. See you next time!